Times are tough in American publishing. There's the growing cost of publication and distribution, new competition for attention from online readers. But you know what still sells better than many other forms of adult fiction? Romance novels.
She ducked her head into his chest, but he grabbed her chin. Look at me, Sabina. Look and know that I love you.
His arm around me, my head on his shoulder, and the image was so powerful that I could feel the thud of his heartbeat under my hand.
Short passages from Jade Lee's Dragonbound and Kristen Higgins' Too Good to Be True.
We're pleased to be at the annual Romance Writers Convention of America in Washington, D.C., and we're here with Nora Roberts, perhaps the best-known romance writer in the world. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So what's your analysis of how the rest of the fiction market in particular is hurting right now, but romance novels are doing well?
Well, of course, I'm biased about romance novels and relationship books, having my roots there, but I think there are books about hope and continuity. They're fun. They're, you know, falling in love is a wonderful thing. And I think during the Great Depression in the 30s, weren't there all those screwball comedies and romantic comedies and great romances, you know, in the movies, that's where it was at. Because it gives people a little time out to just relax and enjoy and feel good. And that's what great fiction and popular fiction does.
Without giving away any secrets, is there, if not a formula, at least a well-practiced and accepted set of principles to writing a good
romance
novel?
There are constants and there is a framework to romance. It's, I think of it as a very large umbrella with many, many spokes. You have to have sexual tension. You have to have emotional commitment, a conflict of some sort, and a happy ending or a satisfying, upbeat ending. And the beauty of romance as a genre is that it's very fluid and it absorbs and accepts elements from every other genre, from horror, from paranormal, suspense, mystery, historical, contemporary, futuristic. Mm-hmm. And as long as you have that core, you can do anything.
I confess to you, a number of years ago, two friends and I got together and we thought, oh, we can do this.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people think
that. And we didn't write a whole novel, but like three stories we sent to a magazine at the time, mm-hmm. and the rejection notices came back in record time.
I bet they did.
It was humbling.
People think that it's much simpler than it is, because a book reads simply does not mean it's simple to write. It's very hard to pull out those emotions and to make it fresh and new. And you know, the writing is very important. Every genre has its constants mm-hmm. and its framework. Every single genre has them. Romance is no different in that way. And it's not easy to write.
Do you think romance novelists are not accorded the respect they deserve as craftspeople?
I find that it seems easier to dismiss novels written primarily by women, primarily for women, as fluff and not really worthy or not important. And, of course, that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I just let that go.
Why is it, may I ask? Because we tooled around one of your workshop sessions just before we came here, and I don't think I saw a single male.
We do have male romance writers. We certainly have male romance readers. But it is primarily a woman's field. It's not exclusively, but primarily, because the books are about emotion. Most male fiction is more about action. And, I mean, I've had some great letters from guys. My favorite is from the trucker who listened to my audiobooks, because one just happened to be in the truck, and, oh, my God, now I'm stuck with this, you know, for cross-country. And he really liked it. Mm-hmm. And so he kept taking them from his wife and sticking them in. And then he said, I was listening, and he named the title to this. And I had to stop at the truck stop. And he said, I had to sit in the truck for like 10 minutes because, man, I'm crying.
Oh.
I'm crying. I can't come
to
the truck stop with all the guys, you know, and crying. So, and he says, but I'm still a guy. And I said, yes, you are still a guy.
Yeah. What have you learned about love over the years from these stories and these books?
What have I learned about love? Well, for me, at least, in the books I write in real life, it takes a lot of humor to get through love and relationships. If you can't laugh, because love is a very strange and funny business. I'm never going to believe that you're in it for the long haul. You may have great sex, you may have that spark, but if you aren't friends and can't laugh together, can't make each other laugh, you're not going to make it.
Ms. Roberts, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Nora Roberts, romance writer. Her latest book, Black Hills, out now.
I decided to try to take advantage of all the concentration of talent at the conference to see if I might have any kind of flair for writing romance instead of literary fiction. So I wrote the opening of a story and asked Carrie Farron, vice president and executive editor of HarperCollins, to take a look. She said she liked the title, His Bosom Heaved.
When Chad Rousseau walked into the IT department on his first day in the dazzling, sprawling high-rise headquarters of the majestic but mysterious Echevarria International Group, he had no idea how his life would soon change, how everything he'd been so rock-solid certain about back in Spartanburg, South Carolina, would turn to rhubarb jelly as soon as he saw her standing against a window overlooking the gleaming, soaring towers of Dallas. He heard her voice first. It was all velvet and honey, but with the unmistakable crack of command. "I am your supervisor," she said. Chad turned around. Sarah Bayer Clementi had smooth, pale skin that seemed to beckon like a soft cloud. She had eyes as deep and blue as the waters of vast, far-off oceans that Chad had only seen on postcards that his father, a missionary in the South Pacific, would send back home to be put on their refrigerator. Her hair was the color of ripe chestnuts, rippled with blinding streaks of bronze.
The rest of the opening of my story is on our blog at npr.org/soapbox. Carrie Farron didn't think much of my story. By the time I'd read just a few sentences, neither did I. I'd written an inept satire, not a real story. I'd played it for laughs, and while, as Nora Roberts suggests, humor can keep love going, satire is mere insincerity in romance writing. Readers can tell the difference and want to read stories that respect the craft and their feelings. Carrie Farron says,
"The people who are doing a great job of this are writing at the top of their game, the best book that they know how. They believe in it, they love it, and the readers respond to that. They can tell when somebody really puts their heart into it. Really puts their heart into it."
And we go now to France for a kind of supermarket Cinderella story. A cashier in France has become a literary sensation. 29-year-old Anna Sam turned her routine job into a humorous memoir, and now her book has been translated into 16 languages and turned Sam into the author she always wanted to be. Here's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
Tribulations of a Cashier is a sociological study of the grocery store world from the viewpoint of the checkout girl. In Anna Sam's book, she dissects the behavior of the shopper, like in this extract read by an actor.
It's lunchtime, and your first customer of the day is stuffing his mouth with a tuna salad sandwich. Chewing noisily, his mouth wide open, you get a glimpse of every ingredient. When you ask to borrow his sandwich for a moment to scan the price, he takes one more giant bite before handing it over. So what's a little mayonnaise on your fingers and crumbs on your register?
Sam presents other shopper types, like the mothers who regularly warn their children that if they don't shape up, they'll grow up to be nothing but a cashier, and the sleazeballs who hit on her while trying to steal CDs inside their boxes of camembert. Despite the indignation, Sam says in some ways the job actually made her feel good about herself.
It's a job where you see every people. It's a job where no one sees you. You see families very happy, family very sad, people very nice, people very bad. And at the end of your day, you say, "Oh my God, I'm happy because I have a normal life. I'm better than I thought."
By taking a job as a cashier, you have also chosen the best route to a super new shape. The cashier's perch is the perfect place to tighten those buttocks, build those biceps, and yes, ladies, even firm up those breasts. Just compare yourself to a customer or a new checkout girl who doesn't have the firming experience you have behind you.
Sam began working as a cashier during college to support her literature studies. When graduation came and went, no other jobs were available, so she stayed on and on. 5 years passed. The work was ungratifying and mind-numbing until she decided to write about it.
I started to see my job different, to see differently people. When you start to explain it with humor, people say, oh, what a funny blog, what a funny diary. I think everything we live can be funny. We have just to see with a good eye.
The automatic gestures and sentences repeated thousands of times a day aren't exactly conducive to cognitive development, but they will permit you to put your esprit on automatic pilot. Enjoy the mental relaxation. You can pick up your faculties on your way out of the store at the end of the day.
Sam first started writing in a blog where she provided a running account of what went on in the world of a cashier. Titled Caissière No Futur, her blog attracted a large number of readers, then newspaper reporters. Soon, publishing houses took note, and Sam had several book offers.
Bonjour, Anna Sam.
Bonjour.
Donc vous êtes,
Since her first book, Sam has become the toast of TV and radio talk shows. With a second book, also about the supermarket world, just off the press, Sam has now left her till behind for good. It wasn't all bad, she says, and reads one of her favorite chapters about how the cash register beeping could sometimes transport you into a dreamlike state.
Il y a foule dans le magasin. Les chariots se croisent, toujours plus nombreux.
The store is packed. Shoppers rush to and fro. Their grocery carts squeak and rattle. A voice over the intercom barks out the latest sales promotions over a backdrop of jangling music. The general brouhaha intensifies. The store is approaching its maximum sound threshold. The squalling of a brat tips it over the edge, opening the passageway to this other dimension.
Sam says her success has been a wonderful surprise. She is heartened to hear from cashiers who say they now find hope and humor in their daily grind. But what makes her happiest, she says, is that people tell her they now treat the checkout girl with respect. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
The English Channel is a mere 21 miles across at its narrowest point, but its powerful tides and abrupt shifts in weather make swimming the channel one of the most difficult athletic feats on the planet. In the summer of 1926, only 5 men in recorded history had swum the channel. Then an American teenager named Gertrude Ederle stuck her toe in the channel waters and made history. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Young Woman and the Sea, a new biography of Ederle by sports writer Glenn Stout.
When Gertrude Ederle, the first woman to swim the English Channel and to set a new speed record for doing so, died 6 years ago at the age of 98, I remember routinely glancing at the photos on the newspaper obituary pages and thinking that she looked quaint. Certainly her modest tank suits with their boy leg cut gave her, to my eye, an air of premature mustiness. So did the old-fashioned name Gertrude. In over 20 years of teaching, I'm pretty sure I've never had one Gertrude among my students. My split-second dismissal of Ederle as quaint is why Glenn Stout's new biography of her, called Young Woman and the Sea, struck me as poignant far beyond the powers of his somewhat lumpy writing style. Because as Stout makes clear, Gertrude Ederle, known in her youth as Trudy, was once the glorious epitome of the modern American girl of the 1920s. She was sporty, muscular, and plucky. She even daringly bobbed her hair. When Ederle made her world-famous swim in August of 1926, she was 19 years old, and she listened to the strains of hot jazz as she swam the frigid, storm-tossed waters of the Channel. The crew aboard a little tugboat beside her spun gramophone records, tunes like Yes, We Have No Bananas and Sweet Georgia Brown. Ederle, as Stout emphasizes, was forward-looking but no feminist. She took on the channel, smearing her body in sheep grease and diving in to master a feat achieved by only 5 men, simply because there were no swimming records left for her to break. Her supportive father had promised her a red roadster if she succeeded, and indeed she got that snappy car, as well as a ticker tape parade down Fifth Avenue. New York City Mayor Jimmy Walker told the teenager, "When history records the greatest crossings, they will speak of Moses crossing the Red Sea, Caesar the Rubicon, and Washington the Delaware. And frankly, your crossing of the English Channel will take place alongside these." But Walker's prediction proved to be nothing more than a politician's bloviations. By the early 1930s, Edderly was working as an anonymous swim coach at a public pool outside New York. Her fame had evaporated as quickly as sea spray on a sun-warmed beach towel. Stout's biography does a good job of fishing Edderly out of the deep waters of historical forgetfulness and setting her in the context of her times, the Roaring Twenties, when public fascination with sporting events as well as with stunts had reached new heights. I cautioned a moment ago that Stout's writing style is lumpy because he often bloats Edderly's story with chapter-long digressions about, for instance, Native American swimming techniques, or like the chapter devoted to the geological history of the English Channel. A leaner biography would have been even more evocative. Edderly, Stout tells us, began swimming as a child on resort beaches in New Jersey. She suffered significant hearing loss after having measles at age 5, and the silence of the sea clearly felt comforting to her. Edderly once said in an interview that, "To me, the sea is like a person, like a child that I've known a long time. It sounds crazy, I know, but when I swim in the sea, I talk to it. I never feel alone when I'm out there." After joining the nascent Women's Swimming Association, Edderly began to wow her teammates and coaches, particularly when she got out of pool competitions and onto the open water of the ocean. She won gold medals in the 1924 Olympics, but on her first attempt to swim the channel in 1925, she became sick and disoriented and had to give up. Stout gives credence to the story that Edderly's channel guide, a resentful old buzzard named Jabez Wolf, may have put poison in the bottle of beef tea he passed to her as she swam. Edderly's second try was golden, despite the heavy wind, rain, and fog that set in during her 14-and-a-half-hour swim. In the thick of the storm, when deep ocean swells made it hard for the panicked folks on the tugboat to keep Edderly in sight, they wanted her to quit. Someone shouted at her to, "Come on out, girl." Edderly, lost in her partial deafness and in the joy of swimming, took a while to respond. According to those aboard, she eventually looked up, smiled, and shouted back, "What for?" It may have only been a fleeting moment, but the way Stout tells it, it just may have been the best moment of Gertrude Edderly's life.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Young Woman and the Sea by Glenn Stout.